Hello, friends, lovers, countrymen, and anyone who doesn't fall under the heading of those first three. I am Ben Vanderveld, and I am one half of the ramshackle steam engine that is Worst Foot Forward. And alongside me is the Isambard to my Kingdom of Brunel, Barry McStay.
Oh, does that mean I'm the caboose if you're the engine?
I don't know what a caboose is. All I know is
That's the back, isn't it? It's the butt. It's the butt of the train.
The train butt. I thought a caboose was a... My only experience of the word caboose is in that song about a moose being loose about the hoose, where I believe it is used in some rhyming couplet. But I've always thought it was a sort of a Edward Lee and nonsense made up word. But apparently a caboose is a real thing.
Like mongoose. Now, I've just Googled the official thing here. A caboose is a crude North American railroad car coupled at the end of a freight train. Provides shelter for crew at the end of a train.
Tremendous stuff. That feels well. Hello, everyone. We hope you're well. We're barely 90 seconds in, and we're already defining pieces of machinery from the 19th century American railroads.
If at some point you are an archaeologist dashing to leap onto a train carrying away the artifact you're trying to track down, the bit you've jumped onto is the caboose.
Oh, the bit with the handrail that Indy is always dangling off. Yeah. That's a caboose. Yes.
Sorry, that should have been the first definition I gave you.
Right, now I'm with you. Now I know what a caboose is. Well, I can die happy. Welcome one and all, as you will know, because I presume that most of you, if not all of you, are literate. This is one of our best of the worst episodes where me and Barry decide to look at the upper echelons of human endeavour and go over five previous episodes of the podcast, but we find the best example of things rather than the worst. And Barry, what are our categories this week? Maestro, music, please. Da, 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 da,
da, da. At number one. we're looking at the subjects that we tackled in episodes 101 to 105 of the podcast, where we looked at the worst in a topic, but we're going to look at the bests. In episode 101, we looked at the world's worst diva in the company of one of the divas of comedy, Suze Kempner. And we decided that Ben's suggestion of Prince Charles was the world's worst diva.
Oh my gosh, I did not realise I won that, nor who I chose, but his behaviour at his own coronation absolutely backs that up.
So we'll dive into Best Diva in a second, but the other topics we'll also be talking about are in 102, we talked about World's Worst Advert with Oliver Powell. In episode 103, we talked about the World's Worst Escape with Tom Hall and Andrew Gruen. In episode 104, we talked about the world's worst guest with Mike Kaplan. And in episode 105, we talked about the world's worst voiceover with Seth Thievo. A real grab bag.
Yeah.
Now, in Worst Diva, he's become king, so he's an even bigger diva since then, King Charles.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
But one of the people we talked about, and Suze picked them as her suggestion purely because of her love for this person, was Freddie Mercury.
Oh, yeah.
And I am going to posit that Freddie is, in fact, the world's best diva.
Of course you are.
Long-time listeners of the show will not be surprised.
Is it a best of the worst show if you don't suggest something queen-aligned?
Well, this one particularly, because, I mean, one of the reasons Suze wanted to mention Freddie was the story about when Queen met the Sex Pistols.
Ah, yes.
And I don't think we mentioned it on the episode originally, but their link goes back a little bit further than the incident that Suze recounted, in that the Sex Pistols, their famous TV interview with Bill Grundy, when they swore and they became infamous to British TV viewers, Queen were meant to be on that slot on the Today programme, as it was called. But Freddie had to go to the dentist for the first time in 15 years, and so the Sex Pistols were brought in to replace Queen.
Really? Because I mean, given what Freddie's teeth were like, that must have been, you know, a serious emergency.
Well, that also puts me in mind of the story that the reason Lord Halifax didn't become the Prime Minister after Neville Chamberlain was removed was because he had to go to the dentist. So, because of dentists, we got Winston Churchill and the Sex Pistols.
Ah, just side issue. You know that obviously the Sex Pistols were famously one of the first people to say fuck on primetime TV. Mm-hmm. And do you know, and I only found this out this week, who the first person to say fuck on British TV was?
Gloria Hunniford.
You've got the correct gender, but the incorrect person.
Valerie Singleton. Sue from Sooty and Sweep and Sue.
I don't feel that you're giving this question the seriousness that it deserves.
Barbara Cartland.
Okay.
Barbara Castle.
No, I'm afraid the correct answer is Mary Whitehouse in a rather
a real,
out of character
a real turn
slip.
Up for the books.
Yeah, she turned heel late in life. no, it was on brand Miriam Margolyes.
Oh, that's good.
When in 1963 she represented Newnham College on University Challenge and incorrectly answered a question, and she like muttered "fuck" under her breath, and that's the first, which again feels like the most perfectly British first utterance of the word "fuck" on TV.
And
is
she's
someone
been,
getting
she's been
the quiz
it,
question wrong?
She's been making it her career ever since.
Yep.
Well, great. After that first instant, the Sex Pistols, Johnny Rotten, sort of not really of the image of the Sex Pistols, was quite a Queen fan. And so they were recording next door to each other at one point. And apparently Johnny Rotten crawled into Queen's studio on all fours, crawled up to Freddie at the piano, said, "Hello, Freddie," and crawled back out again. At which point Peter Hinds, Queen's producer, went into the studio next door where Bill Price was the engineer on Nevermind the Bollocks was, and said, "One of your band members has just crawled on all fours across our studio. Could you make sure he doesn't do it again?" And then on another occasion, Sid Vicious was trying to be rude to Freddie, and the story goes that Peter Hinds says Freddie was confronted by Sid Vicious, who was saying, "Fred, have you succeeded in bringing ballet to the masses yet?" Referencing an interview Freddie had done recently with NME where he discussed his love of ballet. And Fred got up wearing, I think, ballet pumps at the time and quipped, "Aren't you Stanley Ferocious or something?"
No, I thought it was Simon Ferocious.
And then in a later interview, Freddie said it was Simon Ferocious. But whichever one it is, they both work. And Freddie was a very good boxer as a kid. So the story goes that he then grabbed Sid Vicious by the collar and threw him out of the studio.
So talking of Freddie and ballet, my son's current favourite Queen track is probably I Want to Break Free.
Great.
And when he was feeling a bit bored last week, I was like, "Oh, hang on, you've not seen the video for this."
Yes.
So I popped the video on, and he absolutely loved it. But my wife was not in the room when the video started, when they're all doing the cleaning, all dressed as women. But she then entered the room after the bit where they've opened the door under the stairs, and Freddie is in his like ballet reverie, wearing a leotard and rolling across writhing bodies on the floor. And quite rightly, my wife went, "What the hell is this? And why are our children watching it?" Like, it's not the soft porn that it looks like. It's art.
Yes, yeah, exactly. If it's ballet, it's art.
Yeah. Blood.
Yes. I just read a few other fun stories about Freddie, because, you know, you don't need me to tell you how great a performer he was. He once went to a disco in Brooklyn called The Gilded Grape, which was meant to be quite edgy, and I'm quoting Freddie here, said, "I'd heard it was really exciting, but everyone told me I shouldn't go, or if I did, at least make sure I had a fast, bulletproof car waiting for me outside. Everyone tried to warn me about this club, which of course made me all the more determined to go. Not long after we got there, a massive fight broke out, which ended up at our table. Chairs were being smashed, fists were flying, there was blood everywhere. Billie Jean King was petrified, but I loved it. I told her not to worry, and as the fight raged, I grabbed her and took her to the dance floor. It was much more fun than having some cozy dinner back at my hotel." I love the fact that one of the iconic bisexual men of history and one of the iconic lesbians of history are thrown together at this moment.
It's like when you're reading a comic book and one of your favourite superheroes from another story turns up alongside Superman. It's the mashup we never knew we wanted. The Adventures of Freddie Mercury and Billie Jean King.
Oh my god, an Adult Swim cartoon immediately, please. the Queen logo, Freddie designed that himself.
Yep.
If you have a look at it, it's got two lines on it because John and Roger were Leos. Brian May was a Cancer, so there's a crab. And two fairies for Virgo, Freddie said.
Of course.
He was also asked to do a show on Broadway, La Boheme, to co-star with Linda Ronstadt. And he said, "You're kidding, it's totally off tangent, but they asked me to do it. They thought I could sing operatically. The first thing that came into my mind is that I can't do matinees, and they don't realise that I can't sing for 6 or 7 days a week on the same stage. I'd be bored to death."
Yes, Fred.
And he also spoke about his warm-up routine. He said, because he has throat nodules, he had to cut back on red wine, and to warm up he'd do these sort of what he called mock operatics, like runs of notes and things. And he says, I do it naked because there's a certain piquancy about that. With clothes on, it doesn't work, so I sing in the complete raw.
Oh, I mean, I won't take the word piquancy from just any rock star, but yeah, with Freddie, it is just perfect. And of course, he warms up naked.
100%. And he also said that he considered getting an operation on the nodules, but he said, I didn't like the look of the doctor, and I was a bit perturbed about having strange instruments forced down my throat. Freddie, very on brand. Finally, the last story, which I think I was a fact I'd forgotten, is that he said, Rod Stewart, Elton John and I were going to form a band once upon a time called Hair, Nose and Teeth.
I can't be the only one who is hearing that as heads, shoulders, knees and toes.
Yeah. They apparently, it was, you know, over glasses of wine, they talked about forming the supergroup. And then Freddie said, but the next day, when you're sober and Elton says, I'm not going to sing with Rod, and Rod says, I'm not going to sing with Freddie, and I say, well, I'm not going to sing with Elton, you realise it's never going to happen.
It could have been beautiful. Imagine, do you know what? I'm so glad it didn't happen, because just imagine the logo that Freddie would have made.
Yeah.
It would have been disgusting.
It would have looked like one of those Identikit, do you recognize this criminal portraits?
Yes.
So yeah, obviously I think Freddie Mercury is the world's best diva.
Obviously. Should it not be Devo?
Yes, probably. But yeah, you picked King Charles to win the previous episode, so I think we can show a bit of latitude.
That's reasonable. So, listen, I've gone for the obvious one because I'm not a greatly knowledgeable human when it comes to divas. Mariah. She hits every single note on the diva scale because of her 5-octave vocal range. She is, you know, you cannot quibble with the technical ability, some of the styles. She does have one of the top 5 Christmas songs. And is there a more diva-ish time of the year than Christmas? And when do the divas in your family come out? Christmas.
Yeah. And the Il Divo CDs. To go
oh,
with
of
it.
Course.
an ever present Christmas stocking filler.
Yeah, listen, being a diva, it's all about behaving in a way that is hilarious for us as punters to read about, but must be so objectionable to be near.
Yes.
And because I think being a diva, like mostly I find it a pejorative term, but you have discovered with Freddie Away that it can be a positive thing. So some of Mariah's greatest diva hits. Barry, if you and me were lucky enough to be backstage before a Mariah concert, whatever you do, do not talk to her. You may not speak to Mariah on the day before a performance. She cannot, under any circumstances, speak ahead of performing. If you want to communicate with her, you must do it through writing or sign language so that she may preserve her voice.
I like the idea that you can't speak to her for a whole day before the performance. So if the performance is cancelled with 24 hours to go, she just shows up at the venue because no one was able to tell her.
No one's spoken to her. Yeah. Oh, you listen. You've got to protect your voice. It's, you know, it's like footballers insuring their feet. I get it, but I think she goes a little bit over the top with how she takes care of it. So, how many humidifiers do you think she sleeps with in her room?
It's probably some sort of lucky number, so 7.
I like that you've gone for an extra level of divishness and sophistication there. No, it is 20.
Fuck me sideways. That is one dry woman.
Yeah. Oh, God, yeah. Also, you cannot have a naked flame near Mariah, otherwise she will just go up.
She is like kindling.
Yes. Do you know what? That's not a bad name for an album, is it?
Kindling, yeah.
You'll be unsurprised to know that when she gave birth to her children, she played a live version of her song Fantasy so that they could hear the applause of a standing ovation as they entered the world.
Yeah, gross.
Yeah.
Gross.
How
that's one entitled child, isn't it? That's a real contrast to the old-fashioned way of checking the child is alive by giving them a slap.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That reminds me of, I wish I could remember who said it. I think it's an American comic. Might even be Stephen Wright. Has one of my favourite jokes in the world, but only about, I don't know, 30% of people will get it, which was, I was born to the strains of Salieri. which is just it's just stunning. And if you don't get that joke, this is no longer the podcast for you.
Yeah.
So I'm at the stage, 300 episodes in, I'm thinning out the herd.
The worst foot forward, the Salieri to no such thing as a fish is Mozart.
Oh, no. Oh, God, we really are. We really are.
Bring me the slit throat of Andrew Hunter Murray.
Don't say that about Andrew. He's a lovely man.
He's a lovely man.
Let's get Schreiber instead. We'll have him. How do you think she behaved at President Obama's inauguration?
Oh, she left because she was angry. Yeah. She wasn't sat with him or something.
Precisely so. Precisely so. She has made various requests on making public appearances. When she was turning on the Christmas lights at Westfield, which I'll level with you, is quite a demotion for a diva like that. Hmm. She requested 20 white kittens and 100 white doves to be released upon arrival. Which
to be sacrificed in her honour.
Yes, to the great god Quetzalcoatl. But what I'd really like would be for the doves to be released, but within catching distance of the kittens and watching the kittens try and take a couple down.
Didn't realise all the doves had their wings clipped.
Yes. She has refused to leave a helicopter until a hotel gets her a red carpet. She's insisted on adoring crowds of children there to greet her. But my favourite thing about it was she was performing a song called Touch My Body on Good Morning America in 2008 when one of her vocalists was singing a bit too loud for her liking. Now, if she were James Brown, then perhaps after the show she would give them a dressing down, dock them their pay, or perhaps sack them. But no, Mariah, live on TV, sang Stop Singing My Part Now, Baby.
Yeah.
Which is just terrific. So... listen, you know what? I bet I'm just scratching the tip of the iceberg there. Listeners, if you've got your favourite Mariah as a diva story, please tell us. Yeah. So that's why I nominate her. One other person I just want to briefly mention as a diva, the soprano Elizabeth Schwarzkopf. Any idea why I meant mention her? She made a piece of radio history in 1958.
In 1958, was she the first person to say fuck on radio in the UK?
No, no, she was the first person to sing fuck. No, when she appeared on Desert Island Discs, she chose 7 of her own recordings.
Oh, great.
Because she said, I will stick to my own records. I would like to relive my life.
Oh.
But it's a classic diva.
It absolutely is. Fantastic.
I presume the lore of the podcast is if Barry brings Queen, then Queen win.
It's the control alt delete of the podcast.
Yeah, I don't know if that's an iron law, but on this occasion, I am more than happy for Freddie to get the W.
In episode 102, we talked to Oliver Powell about the world's worst advert. And the winner of that episode was Ollie's suggestion of the adverts for 50 Life Insurance, which were very much the stereotype of the brand of the bad insurance advert where a father and daughter after a mum's funeral are discussing how on earth he could have possibly paid for her funeral. And he rather sinisterly says, oh, it was all very easy with thanks to 50 Life and there's still some money left over.
So utterly, utterly creepy.
Yeah. What direction have you gone with for the best advert though, Ben?
I've gone for the most pleasing one. There's so many we could talk about that are funny. I really enjoyed growing up the I think it was the Renault advert with Nicole and Papa. Just because it was really charming and I don't want to dig down into this, but me and my dad kept calling each other that for a couple of years when I was about 10, which let's not do the psychoanalysis on that. But I went for one that is the most pleasing and the one that I genuinely think transcends advertising and has become art, and that is a Honda advert from 2003 called Cog.
Yeah.
And that is the one where they basically spent £1 million to create a real-life Rube Goldberg machine.
Yeah, and it's amazing.
It's astonishing. And they made it out of parts of the new Honda Accord. And, like, hugely influential in terms of, if you think of the videos of OK Go now in particular and other future advertising campaigns. And just to make it work, it is astonishing. And it's one of those things, I am never not happy to watch it.
Yeah.
For those who haven't seen it, just pop Cog into YouTube. So it begins with a close-up of a transmission bearing rolling down a board into a synchro hub, and that in turn rolls into a gear wheel, Cog, which goes onto a board into a camshaft, and there's a pulley wheel, and the camera will track slowly left to right, and there's a domino chain reaction until eventually the electronic systems and water sensors are all triggered. And at the very end of it, the car just is triggered to roll off a platform. Mm. I love that when the sound system is triggered, it plays Rapper's Delight, which is obviously one of the greatest songs of all time.
Absolutely. And
even the narrator at the end, Garrison Keillor, who
Garrison Keillor, yeah.
Garrison Keillor. Oh, God, I've just seen a picture of Garrison Keillor. Look at you. Oh, yes, please. Lovely, lovely horn rim glasses. Very satisfying voice. His tagline is, "Isn't it nice when things just work?" Which is, again, beautiful understatement.
It's great. It shows off the car from the inside out, was sort of the one of the briefs.
Yeah, well, it was when they the advertising agency Veedon and Kennedy were asked to use as inspiration the company motto "You may know Chicara, the power of dreams," and they went on to do a one later on of the "Dream the Impossible Dream" being sung by Andy Williams.
Yeah,
and it's just, you know, loads of different Honda-based modes of transport, from like a skateboard to a motorcycle to a moped to a hot air balloon, and that's wonderful. But the level of industry. So it's actually 2 60-second shots stitched together.
Yeah, it's not all in one, but I mean, it's 2 in 1 is pretty damn good.
Yeah, and to give you an idea of the amount of time and the skill it took, 4 days of filming were required to get the 2 shots, 2 days for each minute long section. The filming sessions were 7 hours long, and they had to take into account things like the ambient temperature, the settling dust, and the humidity, because they need to position things with an accuracy of a 16th of an inch. Yeah. Otherwise, all of these different variables would throw off the movement.
That's one of the reasons that they couldn't do it all in one take as well, because they had to be indoors, and if you do it indoors, you need a studio that's about the size of like 7 aircraft hangars or something like that.
Yeah, well, and by the time production had finished, the accumulated spare parts that they'd used for filming filled 2 articulated lorries.
Yeah.
And ultimately it took, the rumours were that it took over 600 takes, but actually it took 100 in the end.
Yeah, and they were so ahead of their time in a way, because they did sort of additional content before that was kind of a thing.
Yes, they did.
They did, like, they had a making of documentary and a virtual tour of a Honda Accord on a disc, and they released the original music video of Rapper's Delight and an illustrated guide of all the parts in the ad. And yeah, they did lots of tie-in stuff in a way that marketers hadn't really done before then.
Yeah, that's true. It's just utterly beguiling and wonderful, and also not for a problematic product either.
What? Which would... a petrol-using car?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't see any issue with that whatsoever. Oh, dear.
It was responsible, frankly, for increasing Honda's revenue by nearly $400 million. So in many ways, Cog is the reason that the climate crisis came about.
I think I would like to take back my ill-chosen words. It's the Thomas Midgley of adverts. Oh, I've been hoisted upon my own petard here. This has gone terribly badly. Yeah.
From a purely aesthetic point of view, it is a really great ad.
It is. What are you going to put up against it?
I looked at the other sort of iconic ad from the early to mid-2000s, which is Balls.
Oh, with the Jose Gonzalez track.
It is indeed. The Sony TV ad for the new Sony Bravia, featuring all of the multicolored balls bouncing down the hills in San Francisco, advertising their new LCD screen. There was so much footage they shot for this. I should say, Cog, the original ad of Cog is 2 minutes long, and then they released sort of cut down versions of it, because buying a 2 minute advertising slot is really expensive. And similarly, the footage they shot for Balls, which I'm sure most people know, it's, like I say, lots of multicolored balls bouncing down those really steep hills in San Francisco to the tune of Heartbeats by Jose Gonzalez. There was so much great footage that the first time they aired it, Sony bought the entire ad break on Sky Sports 1 immediately before Manchester United played Chelsea.
Yeah, well, it's similarly with Cog. They put it out before a Grand Prix. I forget which one it was. And also the UEFA Champions League final. I mean, it's the right thing to do, and you can afford to do that if you're a massive company like Honda. But they were like, we got some genius here. We're putting it in the most expensive primetime slots.
Yeah, that, and the first 2.5 minute version of Balls had the entire Jose Gonzalez song played all the way through. And then during the match between United and Chelsea, the digital hoardings around the edge of the pitch showed bouncing balls all the way through.
Oh, that's very clever.
Yeah, and then they did the 60-second version that most people will have seen during the halftime ad break.
What's also remarkable with that, did you know that the song in it was a cover?
Yes, I think I did know that.
And it's one of those covers where it's completely unlike the original. Like, the original is sort of like this really quite grungy, distorted dance rock number. And obviously, the Jose Gonzalez one is this gossamer, thin, little folksy piece of business.
Yeah, which absolutely works with it. And the genesis of the ad was interesting because it came at a time when Sony were really struggling. They had a big fall in profits. They had to let 10,000 people go in a restructuring, and it was still at the time where convincing people to buy a flat TV was a bit questionable.
Oh,
but people
okay.
weren't sure if a flat TV would be powerful enough. You know, if it doesn't have the big box behind it, where's all the machinery going? So a lot of thought went into this new advert. It was the advertising. Company was Fallon, who came up with this idea. And the idea, the script was essentially bounce a million colorful balls down a San Francisco hill. That
sure.
was it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's the elevator pitch. I would imagine that the logistics were somewhat more challenging.
Yes, absolutely. The whole premise is that they wanted to give this idea of like color exploding out of these new LCD screens. That was the big selling point. LCD means we're going to be able to do brighter colors, so we're going to visualize that using these balls. But obviously getting a million balls is quite tricky, so they tried ordering them from China, but apparently that was going to take months. And so in the end they settled for just 250,000 balls, basically calling every fun fair and toy shop across America and trying to buy them out of as many colorful rubber balls as they could get. But and the director Nikolai Fuchslig and the crew, they were absolutely determined. They didn't want to do any camera trickery. They wanted to do every shot of the advert had to be filmed live on a camera, and that obviously involved a massive effort. 23 members of the crew, many of them wearing body armor.
Why?
Because they were having 250,000 balls bounce down a hill at them.
Yeah, but they're just like balls from a ball pit, right?
Yes, but they're rubber balls and momentum.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, they're not just plastic balls, they're rubber balls bouncing. They set up barricades and they had riot shields as well. And not only were they being bounced down the hill, but they were actually being fired out of 12 cannons, like tennis ball cannons.
Oh, God, good lord.
Especially modified for these, and they'd shoot volley after volley of these balls. Which, obviously, when you slow it down in slow motion and you put the Jose Gonzalez song, it looks very beautiful. In real life, the idea of these rubber balls being launched at the crew in riot gear is a real image. And my other favourite thing about it is that to shoot it, they're shooting these balls down actual streets, every drain on the hill had to be taped up before shooting.
Otherwise, all those poor Ninja Turtles that live in the sewers would just be overwhelmed with bouncing balls.
Yes, so the balls did make it down to the bottom, and then a team of 50 local students on roller skates swept all the balls away from the bottom of the hill, and they passed them out to local children who'd come to watch.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so I think in terms of sort of iconic ads from that period, everyone will remember that ad. Because of the iconic level of it, the simplicity of the concept, the setting, the song, it all sort of tied together. It's one of those things where all of the aspects of the, from idea to conception to execution all came together. But I have to say, I did also have Cog as my first choice until you suggested it, and then I had Balls as my backup, so.
Yeah, that's fair. And let's be fair, whilst we're both saying this, the correct answer is actually the Guinness advert with the squirrel. Where
lots of really good Guinness ads. I think we said this at the time when we were recording with Ollie. The best ads are often for the biggest brands because you already know what the product is.
Yeah.
So they can be more conceptual and they can be a bit artistic. They don't have to be like, what's my product? Well, let me tell you.
Yeah. Well, and that's as well with the Guinness ones, they are absolutely perfectly pitched at, again, real proper art is going on, and they somehow manage to skirt that line between pretension and whatever the opposite of pretension is.
Unpretension.
Thank you.
there's the great McDonald's ads at the moment. Did Edgar Wright direct them? Bomb, bomb, and people just like wiggling their eyebrows, all inspired by the Golden Arches.
Yes, very clever. I mean, it is clever. I find it deeply irritating, but it is. I appreciate the cleverness.
But again, it's one of those ads where they're like, they don't have to do anything apart from like just be a video. Like,
yeah,
the job has been done for you by 70, 80, 90 years worth of company history.
Well, that's it. On the flip side, it's just very insidious displaying the point of advertising, because you're like, but surely we don't need this because everyone buys McDonald's. And it's like, no, because the way advertising works is we just need to constantly remind you that we're here and you don't need to use anything else. And
By the way, folks, while we're at this point of the show, please do subscribe for us on patreon.com/worstfootforward.
Gosh, that's right. Yes, I cannot recommend Patreon. And if you, if just 250,000 people donate to us on Patreon, then me and Barry will dress up as horses and dive into the sea in beautiful monochrome and bag a surfer.
Yeah. Oh, yes, please. In episode 103, we talked to Tom Hall and Andrew Gruen about the world's worst escape. I loved this story. I remember at the time being blown away by this one. It was the story of George Billy Hunt, who was imprisoned in Port Arthur in Tasmania, decided to dress up as a kangaroo to escape from this prison. But some hungry guards saw this kangaroo and started lining up shots to try and take down a creature to feed themselves. And so George Hunt had to promptly surrender and turn himself back in again.
It's just, I think all of the stories in that episode, because this is a lovely thing doing these shows, listeners. If you've not heard that episode, sometimes they're good to go back and listen to. And the escape one, I think everyone brought a proper worldie of a story.
Yeah, yeah. It's a really, really fun episode. I did a quick search through some famous escapees. Mary Queen of Scots escaping from a castle dressed in a white cloak. Mm-hmm. John Dillinger with his fake gun. But I hit on Alfred George Hines. Have you heard of him?
I'm guessing he is not the gentleman behind baked beans.
No, it's Hines as in H-I-N-D-S. And in 1953, he was imprisoned in Nottingham Prison for a robbery, which he said he didn't commit. And he was so sure he hadn't committed it that he decided to escape from prison. And the way he did that is he memorized the shape of the prison key and he made a copy of it in the workshop in the prison. And then unlocked the door to his cell, climbed a 20-foot wall, and then got onto a truck, which a friend was driving, and escaped. And was recaptured 8 months later.
Tremendous. Obviously, extremely impressive to memorise a key. Mm. But surely, when he's in the workshop, and the prison guard is there, he's going, excellent work, everyone. You're learning a skill for the future, so you can go and work in Timpsons, and we'll lower the recidivism rates. But what are you making there? Absolutely not a key, sir. Certainly not the key to my cell. Like, how is he disguising that?
I think the key detail is this was the 50s.
Yes, very easy to escape from prison in the 50s, or indeed in the year 2023.
Yes. Yeah. He was given a nickname by the press when he was recaptured. He was nicknamed Houdini Hines. And then after this rearrest, he decided to take his case to court and say, I shouldn't have been rearrested. He said there was some flaw in the reasoning behind him being rearrested. And so he had his day in court. And in court, he had some accomplices smuggle a padlock into the courthouse and attach a fitting to the door of a toilet cubicle. Hines asked two police officers who were guarding him to take him to the bathroom where they took off his handcuffs so he could, you know, deal with himself. And as soon as the handcuffs were off, Hines and a friend shoved the police officer into the cubicle, stuck the padlock onto the fixture, locked them in, and escaped from the courthouse.
Yeah! Oh! I mean, obviously bad men, but that's so ingenious.
He was recaptured at an airport 5 hours later. I think you can see where this is going. He was sent to Chelmsford Prison, where less than a year later, he escaped for a third time. He made a copy of a key, this time for the bathhouse, climbed out of a skylight over the prison wall. Again, a friend was waiting in a car and he fled to Ireland, where he worked as a used car salesman under a false name for several years. Before he was stopped and, yeah, this is always the case. He was arrested for a different thing. He was driving an unregistered car. And then they realised who he was and he was returned to England. And he served out the rest of his sentence at Parkhurst Prison. But after this, he joined Mensa And he was invited to, you know, speak to various things. He took part in a debate at the Polytechnic, now the University of Westminster Student Union. In 1967, he was there, and during a drink at a pub after the debate, six students for a ragweek stunt kidnapped him, marched him along a street to a basement room of the college, and locked him in. And Hines grabbed a bunch of keys from them, turned the tables, and locked them in instead.
This is incredible.
Yeah, absolutely top-notch work from Alfred George Hines, the Houdini Hines, who escaped from prison three times and also managed to escape from the clutches of some drunken students. So, yeah, well, I like him.
Love it, love it, love it, love it. Mine is very different. Yours is full of mischief. Mine is a woman who we need to know more about. I'm going to tell you about Countess André de Jong, who was a member of the Belgian Resistance in the Second World War. She was born in Sherbeek in Belgium under the German occupation in the First World War. And she was the daughter of a headmaster of a primary school. And she idolised Edith Cavell, an extremely famous British nurse who ministered to troops on both sides during World War One, and was captured and shot by the Germans. André grew up to become a nurse inspired by Cavell. And when she was 23, the Germans invaded occupied Belgium. And she helped smuggle British troops out of there. In 1940, she moved to Brussels, where she volunteered for the Red Cross, and she looked after Allied troops. And at that time, a network of safe houses was developed, where many British soldiers who were left behind at Dunkirk and escapees from various prisons went through. And she organised a network of safe houses whilst also procuring civilian clothes so they wouldn't be identified, false ID papers, and also nursing them back to health.
Hmm.
She was described by a British airman who helped her out as a frail young girl, appears to be 20 years old, very pretty, pleasant, kind, cheerful, and simple. She seems to have the carelessness of a young student that would go on vacation after passing her exams. By the end of the war, and some of the things I'm going to tell you about, a British colonel described her as a pure heroine of legend.
Cool.
Yeah. So, she worked alongside two gentlemen, Henri de Blicky and Arnold Depay, and they organised a group of friends to help all of these escapees and airmen. And this became what was known as the Comet Line, which was the largest escape and evasion lines in World War II. And they also referred to themselves as the DDDs after their
enormous breasts.
Yes. it was after their last names, which... Because they all had does in. But yes, it was. Thank you, Barry. So de Blicky was arrested and executed in 1941. But meanwhile, what Depay did was set up this escape line. And it's astonishing, because the way it would work is she would walk them up to the border. And on between 16 to 24 occasions, between 1941 and 1942, she escorted the airmen from the border in France over to Spain. That is across the Pyrenees, Barry.
Wow.
She literally walked these men back and forth over the Pyrenees around 20 times.
Heroic walking tours.
Yeah, precisely. And she, in total, escorted about, we reckon, 118 airmen over the border during this time.
Cool.
And eventually, in 1943, she was betrayed by a farmer in France who was a part of the Vichy regime. She was interrogated 19 times by the Abwehr and twice by the Gestapo. And she admitted to being the leader of the Comet Line in order to protect her father, who was also under suspicion. But the Germans refused to believe that she was anything other than a minor helper in the Comet Line. And basically, probably their... what's the word I'm looking for? Patronising misogyny probably saved her from execution. In her absence, the Comet Line continued to function and helped a further 700 Allied soldiers reach safety by the end of the war. and she just an incredible character. For her wartime efforts, she was awarded the Medal of Freedom in the United States, the George Medal from the United Kingdom, the Légion d'honneur in France. She became a Chevalier of the Order of Leopold from Belgium, which I think is probably not an honour that is aged particularly well, but we'll let that go. And in 1985, she was made a Countess. After the war, she went on to work in leprosariums in the Belgian Congo, and then in Cameroon, in Ethiopia, and in Senegal. Whilst working in a leper colony in 1959, she met the novelist Graham Greene. Graham Greene sort of records this in his journals. He asked her why she'd come to the Congo to do this, and she said, because from the age of 15, I wanted to cure lepers. If I had delayed any longer, it would have been too late. So just a woman with a calling. And she died in 2007 at the age of 90, and is interred at Le Combre Abbey in Brussels. And a final word from her describing her work. This is what she apparently said to a downed airman. "My name is André. I would like you to call me by my code name, which is Didi, which means little mother. From here on, I will be your little mother and you will be my little children. It'll be my job to get my children to Spain and thence to freedom."
Oh, well done her.
What a woman, eh?
Well, puts Alfred George Hines back in his box, from which he promptly escapes.
Yeah, I think I'm afraid yours is magnificent, but I think I'm going to take that one.
Yeah. In episode 104, we talked to Mike Kaplan about the world's worst guest, and our selection was Mike Kaplan.
Yes.
At Mike's own suggestion.
He was so engagingly unhelpful.
Yeah, 100%. What have you done for this one, Ben?
Oh, this one's just really easy. It's Billy Connolly whenever he's on the Parkinson show.
Oh, yes, please.
It's not difficult, is it? I mean, I know that any British listener over the age of 35 or 40 will have watched countless clips of this, and I'm sure many of our listeners around the world. But it's the Michael Parkinson, Sir Michael Parkinson, who recently passed away, our most famous interviewer. A very good interviewer, apart from when he was occasionally a little bit too lads golf club towards Helen Mirren. And my best description of his interviewing technique was, someone asked Barry Cryer, a great joke writer, what it's going to be like when he's interviewed by Michael Parkinson, because he's about to go on the show. And he said, he will interview you from a kneeling position.
Yes.
Which I think is a beautiful description. But it is, these are the shows that made Billy Connolly, and are almost as iconic as some of his stand-up acts. And it's,
yeah,
it was, I was on the show because, you know, Billy Connolly was a stand-up comedian before it really existed in the form we know in this country. Look, and what's glorious, it's long before any Oxbridge graduates came along to define what alternative comedy was. He was doing this in the mid-70s, having been a folk singer, telling hilariously shocking stories. And obviously he told the most brilliant joke about having his bicycle stolen.
Yes.
Which I am going to tell, just in case anyone hasn't heard it, which will not sound as good because I'm not telling it in a Glaswegian brogue, but yeah. About a man going to the pub and his mate's there. "Oh, you're late, what are you doing?" He's like, "Oh, I've just murdered my wife." He's like, "What are you talking about?" It's like, "Yeah, no, I've just killed her. Just done her in." He's like, "No, I don't believe you." And he's like, "What do you want to see?" It's like, "What, where is she?" He's like, "Oh, she's at home, come and see." So he invites his mate back and he goes, where's your wife? He goes, "Oh, she's just round the back." And they go around the back and there's a big pile of dirt, and sticking out of it are two arse cheeks. And his mate goes, "Is that her?" And he goes, "Yeah." He goes, "Why have you buried her like that?" And he goes, "Oh, well, I've got to have someone to park my bike, don't I?" Which is just perfect. Do not see it coming. It has everything. Yes. It has life, death, sex, marriage, bicycles.
Yeah. Not that necessarily he was one of the pioneers of it, but he was certainly maybe the first instance of a comic that British audiences saw who weren't just writing jokes, but who talked a lot about personal experience. A lot of their stories are based on life around them day to day.
Well, what's great now, here's a word that I think our parents' generation valued much more than ours. Listen, maybe we still value it, but we don't use the word. He was the greatest of raconteurs. Mm. But I'd be fascinated to know if someone wanted to fact check me on that or had other suggestions, but I feel like raconteurs, and particularly raconteurs on talk shows in this country before Billy Connolly, were generally high-minded intellectuals from middle and upper classes. Peter Ustinov. Yeah. And he was like the first working-class raconteur.
He just finds joy and humour in everything.
Yes.
Like, his outlook on the world is, why is that tiny thing funny to me?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And, and that's it. He's like a proper bon vivant in the best possible way. I mean, he has, I don't know if it's his own phrase, but my one of my favourite phrases, you should always enter a room looking windswept and interesting.
Yes. Yeah, and one of the, you know, obviously sad that Michael Parkinson died. One of the nice things that has happened as a result of that is the resurfacing of all of his interviews with Billy Connolly. They've just been doing the rounds again.
Yeah.
Encourage people, if you're a listener and you've not necessarily encountered Billy Connolly beyond maybe knowing his name from a film or two, absolutely go and find the clips of him appearing on the Parkinson show.
It is world class, and I'm sure he did do appearances on American shows, and he's just what you want. You know, it doesn't fine promote your film, but with him you'll get a filthy story, a story from his life, a great bit of sort of pop philosophy. And this is really important. When Sean Locke died, people said this about him as someone on panel shows. Sean Locke is hilarious, but he was a brilliant listener and a brilliant enjoyer of other people. Yes, my favorite video of him is him losing his ability to function at Joe Wilkinson telling a poem. Like, and Billy Connolly was the same. For someone who is a global superstar, he loved listening to other people.
Yeah, he was on. There's a clip of him and Tom Cruise when they're promoting, I think, The Last
Samurai.
And he even like elevates Tom Cruise to try and make Tom Cruise look funny. Like, he's perfectly happy to like be a double act and not just take over the show. But like, yeah, he's a team player.
Yes,
very good, Billy Connolly. Well, obviously Billy's going to win.
Obviously.
And so I thought the best thing to do, rather than pick a specific guest, was find out what defines the best guest. What are the archetypal behaviours?
Oh, are we going to Debrett's?
Not quite. I found an essay by a writer called David Laskin, an American writer and humorist, from the 1984 issue of Esquire, which he updated in the 2020s for the modern world. But the basic premises of how you should behave as a guest at a party include: give a clear answer if you're coming or not. Very straightforward. Mm-hmm. In the words of David Laskin, the worst thing you can do is appear to be holding out for a better offer.
Yeah.
Bring a gift. If you're bringing flowers, have them sent the day before with a handwritten card so the host can put them out on the table. Otherwise, you're giving them another job to do on the day. Otherwise, nice bottle of red wine or scotch, some fancy chocolates or assortment of fine cheeses. A bad idea, Twister. Never arrive early. Fair enough. You don't want to be sort of hanging around while they're still, you know, getting food ready or something like that. Greet your host by name when you arrive.
Well, yes, that's awful if you're turning up to everybody and going, oh, hello, you.
Yes, you. He also says, punching someone on the shoulder and using an anatomically impossible nickname is not an acceptable greeting.
That is a lovely rule.
Especially if you're greeting someone's mom. Be a gracious guest.
Sorry, I'm just imagining going and meeting someone in a room and going like, all right, tits.
Yeah. He says, be a gracious guest. Don't wander around the kitchen getting in everyone's way. You know, if you're there as a guest, be a guest. Like, sit down, do the things that your host expects you to do as the guest in their home. When you're asked if you'd like a drink, of which kind of soup you prefer, don't answer whatever's easiest. Give an answer, make the decision for them.
Yes. I mean, it's a good rule for comedy and improv and a good rule for life. Be specific.
Yes,
vagueness is not helpful ever.
Yeah. What else did he say? He said that you should mingle. Don't be the cipher who spends an entire party picking out the cashews from the mixed nuts. The only thing worse than an obnoxious guest is a dead, silent, potentially psychotic one who stares blankly at the rest of the party.
Yes, strong agree. Not necessarily going to be in those terms, but yep, agree.
Probably dressed in a corduroy turtleneck or something like that. We've all been at parties with that person. I've been at parties where I've been that person, I think.
Yeah, no, that's fair. I would like to write a story with a character where there is an overly prim character simply called Corduroy Turtleneck. You know, you can imagine sort of like a New York intellectual.
Yes, yeah. Part of the club with Dorothy Parker and all of those people.
Yes.
Don't touch the TV remote. modern times. Don't stick on YouTube or something like that.
Oh, God, no.
Offer timely help. So he says, be a guest. Don't be getting in the way in the kitchen. But if, you know, if there's a spill or something, offer to help tidy up that. Eat when you're served. If the guest says eat up, don't do that thing that we politely do where you think, you know, if the suggestion isn't that, you know, the food will take ages and that, you know, you should wait for the host to sit down, do wait. But if the host says eat up, then just do that. Don't smoke. Obvious.
Yep.
Volunteer to clear the dishes, but don't stack them on the table. This isn't a restaurant. Leave at the right time. Here are some good signs. It's time to go. They've run out of booze. The host is yawning, consulting his watch, bickering with his spouse in the kitchen. People are milling around the door, or it's dawn. And finally, thank them again. Now grab a piece of paper and a pen and write a quick thank you note, including one detail from the evening to prove you were actually there.
Yeah, I mean, it's real basic don't be an arsehole advice.
Yeah, it's really great to have. But I think it's very safe to assume that Billy Connolly would stick to all of those rules. So Billy Connolly, the best guest.
Mm-hmm. Oh, hi, folks. Just to warn you that Ben's microphone batteries died at this point of the podcast. For about 3 minutes, his microphone will sound slightly different before we realise and get him back. So if Ben sounds a bit different in this section, don't worry, it'll fix itself very shortly. Now, where were we?
Finally, we talked about the world's worst voiceover with Seth Tivo, where we explored the wonderful back catalogue of Orson Welles' voiceover jobs for the likes of Paul Masson Wine and Findus Frozen Peas. Those have become increasingly well known in recent years, so I'm sure if you haven't listened to the initial episode, you might be aware of them. If you haven't, go check out YouTube and find the director's cuts of those. They're so good. But I've gone a bit route one with this. I've gone in search of the voice of God, Thunderthroat himself.
You've gone for the same one as me, Don LaFontaine.
Don LaFontaine, yes. The man who voiced so many American film trailers back in the day when they had narrators. They kind of don't really have that anymore. It's more clips from the film and lines from the film. They don't tend to have trailers in the same way anymore.
No, just in case our listeners don't know who we're talking about, what is his most famous catchphrase?
In a world.
I'm afraid I didn't feel that in my boots, but yes.
I need to gargle a bit more turpentine before I But yeah, no, he does claim that he set up a company where doing voiceover stuff, and he claimed that they were the first people to coin the inner world phrase. And examples of trailers where the inner world line is used that LaFontaine voiced includes Mad Max 2 or The Road Warriors was known in America. In a world with gas, this is a land that prays for a hero. Or in Goodfellas, in a world that's powered by violence, on the streets where the violent have power, a new generation carries on an old tradition. It's quite lengthy. Alien 3, in a world where the sun burns cold, the wind blows colder, a visitor has come, but not by herself. Planet of the Apes, the Tim Burton one, in a world where freedom is history, brutality is law. And South Park, in a world fraught with corruption, four young boys united by fate, torn apart by destiny, somewhere between love and honour, between courage and not courage, between Kansas and Utah, there lies South Park. And yeah, it's amazing how famous you can become for your voice, but nobody know at all who you are, up until very late in life, really.
Yeah.
He voiced more than 5,000 film trailers, hundreds of thousands of TV ads, promotions, video game stuff over four-decade career. He was born in 1940. And
Born in Duluth, Minnesota. Do you know who else was born in Duluth, Minnesota?
No, go on, tell me.
Bob Dylan.
Oh, that's a good voices of their generations.
Yeah. Oh, God, can you imagine if they ended up with the opposite job?
Or a duet, a Dylan LaFontaine duet.
That'd be incredible.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man?
In a world where... in a world where men were men and women were hoovers.
Yeah, he had a career in the army and worked as an audio engineer for the U.S. Army Band and the U.S. Army Chorus, and then kept working as an audio engineer after discharge, worked in studios in New York. He worked on radio spots for Dr. Strangelove with a producer called Floyd Peterson, and then they went into business together, producing adverts for the movie industry, largely on radio.
I'm sorry. I've got to say, Floyd Patterson was that?
Floyd Peterson.
Floyd Peterson, that's not the name of a radio producer. That is a super middleweight boxing champion.
Yes. Working on the 1964 Western Gunfighters of Casa Grande, LaFontaine had to fill in for an unavailable voice actor to present something to MGM. And then MGM bought the spots, and LaFontaine's career took off after that. An actor hadn't shown up for these spots. Yeah, that was, it was sort of by accident he fell into that side of the job. He became head of Kaleidoscope Films, producing movie trailers, and then started his own company, Don LaFontaine Associates. Worked for Paramount for a bit, and then just went freelance, working, doing his own voiceover work.
What's remarkable is it's all very well having that voice, but yet to have that work ethic, to be so ubiquitous.
Absolutely, he was doing 60 promos a week, sometimes 35 in a day at his peak.
And I love that he is the voice of Viacom. So when you see the... And it's all what we were saying with the advertising thing, that when you're as big as Guinness or McDonald's, you don't need that much, the hard sell. When you have the voice of God with you, he can just say the name of your company and that'll do, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. The studios really wanted him. Like, his income was, he was earning in the millions. Studios could command a very high fee. Other trailers he did Terminator 2, Shrek, Friday the 13th, Law and Order, Batman Returns. Then in 2006, Geico, the American company, began an advertising campaign where actual customers told their stories of interacting with the company Geico, accompanied by a celebrity who helped make the story interesting. And LaFontaine was the celebrity in one of those ads, which began airing in 2006 in August. And in the ad commercial, he was introduced by the voiceover to the commercial as that announcer guy from the movies, with his name printed on screen to identify him. And he began telling the customer story with the Inner World thing. And he said it was only really at that point, 2 years before he died in 2008, that people began to recognize him in the street because of appearing in those adverts after, you know, 40 years of doing voiceovers for trailers that millions of people will have seen.
We should do a special on people who you know but you don't know who they are.
Yeah.
Or people who you know but you've no idea what they look like. And he's absolutely the king of them.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, just because that phrase is so, again, it's one of those things. Everyone, the default if you're doing a movie trailer impression is to default to Inner World and doing that voice. In the same way that if you're doing a nature documentary, you would default to doing David Attenborough.
Yes. And well, and also what's great about this, the reason I would say that you would call him the voice of God, and it's not just because it's so powerful, but the Inner World catchphrase, it's very Book of Genesis, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. It's very, something very biblical.
Yeah.
He's referenced very, very nicely in a film called Inner World, but written and directed and starring Lake Bell, which the cast includes Nick Offerman and Dimitri Martin as well. And it's all about, you know, warring voiceover artists, and there's clips of his work and people doing homage to him in the film. And he died in 2008 because I think people would be unsurprised to know he was a heavy smoker.
Yeah, that's him and Freddie, two heavy smokers in this episode.
Yeah, absolutely. Not that we're condoning smoking or anything, but in a world where vapes are taking over, one man sets out to fight back for Philip Morris. His name, Barry McStay.
Do you know what he believed helped maintain his voice? Other than the smokes.
Did he like a drink of whiskey or something as well?
Nope, it was a food stuff.
Oh, food. Subway sandwiches.
Yes, yeah, he would have a 6-inch sub before every recording.
Yeah.
It was, no, raw garlic.
Oh, that's meant to be really good for you.
Me and my wife both love pickled garlic.
Raw garlic for, apparently very good for hospital stomach bugs and things like that. You're meant to, yeah, good for the immune system.
And my other favourite thing I found out about him, do you know what is unique about his limousine?
Did it have his facial hair imprinted on the bumper?
Yes, it absolutely did. That's incredibly well guessed. Now, it had a soundproof recording studio built into it.
Because I knew he'd built a home studio, as many voiceover artists do, so they don't have to, you know, be traveling to various different studios around the city to record. They can just record from home once that technology was built. But yeah, being able to do it on the move.
Right.
Top-notch stuff by Don LaFontaine. So I think it's quite nice that we've both come with the same offering to round things off.
Yeah, that's very serendipitous.
In a world where Ben and Barry are pitched against one another, they come together to celebrate a common hero. That hero, me.
Very good. Donald Leroy LaFontaine.
Yes.
The voice of God, king of the movie trailers, is the world's best voiceover. Well, that's it for another episode of Worst Foot Forward, where we've turned sunny side up for a week. Don't worry, normal service will be resumed in a couple of weeks. In the meantime, thank you as ever for listening. Thank you to all of you who support us on patreon.com/worstfootforward. If you have the capability of donating a few quid and keeping the lights on here, we would very much appreciate it. Winter is coming and the geese aren't fat enough yet. You can also find us on the various social medias. The podcast is on @worstfoot on the usual platforms. Ben is @vanderlaugh. Go check out Ben's Instagram. A lot of fun clips of Ben up there at the moment. And I'm on @basmaxday on the platform formerly known as Twitter. And we'll see you in a couple of weeks. Thanks as ever for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye.